This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ice Cube became famous in the late 80s as one of the originators of gangster rap. Many of his lyrics were about gangs, drive-bys, and confrontations with the police in South Central L.A. So it might surprise you to hear that the new movie he stars in and produced is a family comedy. Cube made his movie debut in Boys in the Hood. Now he has his own production company, which has made several hit films that he also starred in, including Friday and Barbershop. He also co-starred with George Clooney and Mark Wahlberg in Three Kings. In his new family comedy, Are We There Yet?, he plays a single man who falls in love with a recently divorced mother of two children. He hates kids, but in the hopes of winning her over, he agrees to escort them on a 300-mile trip so that they can spend New Year's Eve in Vancouver, where their mother has to be on business. The kids are hoping their mother will reunite with their father, so they do everything imaginable to scare off Cube, and he does everything in his power to prevent that from happening. After they destroy his car and get thrown off their plane, the kids board a train and leave him behind. He mounts a horse and is riding alongside the train when the children's mother calls his cell phone.
Hey, how you doing, baby?
Hi. Is everything okay?
Oh, yeah, everything is cool. Can I call you right back?
Wait. I want to say hi to the kids.
Oh, okay. She want to talk to you guys and make sure everything is all right.
Hi, Mom!
Hey!
I love you.
Love you too. Bye.
Scoot over, I'm coming aboard.
That's a bad idea.
Says who?
Says the guy who put all that junk there.
Oh, snap!
Ice Cube, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
If someone said to you in the 1980s when you were first getting famous as a gangster rapper that in 2005 you were going to be producing and starring in a movie in which you got subjected to every indignity imaginable by a couple of really obnoxious children, what would you say?
I would have told them they was crazy. You know, all I wanted to do was rap back then. You know, I had no other ambitions but to, you know, get my songs played on the radio, you know. And here I am, you know. It's been a roller coaster ride of a career for me. And, you know, it's fun and it's still kind of evolving. So, you know, I wouldn't have believed you back then.
No, something that's a kind of in-joke about you. There's a scene where you have to get an off-duty pharmacist to give you a prescription because one of the kids has asthma and he needs his inhaler really badly. So you give the pharmacist your famous scowl, your sneer, in which one corner of your lip is raised. And I mean, it's a look we were familiar with from, you know, from back to the 80s.
Yeah, definitely.
And you also teach one of the kids how to do it, so if he ever needs to intimidate somebody, he can too. And it's a funny scene.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool scene. You know, I've been known for that for the longest. You know, if you look at a lot of my early pictures, you know, all I did was frown.
That's right.
Make the scowl, but, you know, to teach it, you know, a youngster, and he had it pretty good.
And how did you first use that look? How did that become such a part of your persona?
I mean, it's just a natural look. I mean, it's just
the scowl.
I've always had it. You know, I've always been accused of looking mean. You know, in school, as an adult, it's just a look that I have. It's kind of a natural look, and you know, it's now it's a famous look for me. You know.
So what are some of the films that you saw as a child that made a big impression on you?
Oh, man, I've seen everything. There was a movie theater wasn't too far from my house, and it was a time in my life where, you know, I didn't need my family. I can just go. You know, I was 12, 13 years old, and we would live at the movie theaters every week, you know, and see from, you know, Grease to Meatballs to Jaws to Star Wars to you know, Uptown Saturday Night to Car Wash. And, you know, we would see everything that came through there and see it more than once, you know. I remember seeing, like, Saturday Night Fever at the movies. You know, back then, movies stayed out 12 weeks. You know, they didn't just stay in the theater 2 or 3 weeks and we're out of there. So, you know, you go there every week and Saturday Night Fever's playing. Let's go see that again. You know what I mean? So, you know, I got a chance to see a lot of these movies over and over again.
My guest is Ice Cube, and he produced and stars in a new family comedy called Are We There Yet? That opens a little later in January. When was the first time you heard rap? I mean, how old were you? What were you listening to when you first heard it?
The first rap song I heard was Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang, 1979.
That's pretty much the beginning of recorded rap.
Pretty much, yeah. I was 10 years old, and I was on my way to the dentist. My uncle was taking me, and he had a big radio that he would play because his car radio didn't work. And he had this one song on there. He had, you know, the Ohio Players. He had Rick James, the Commodores. And then this one song came on, which was Rapper's Delight. And it just blew my mind that, you know, people were saying what I considered nursery school rhymes to music. And it was something that just captivated me. I listened to that tape over and over and over again till my uncle said, look, we can't listen to the song no more. You know, get you in this dentist. We can't listen to the song no more. But I was caught from then, and I was always seeking it out and always looking for, you know, where could we find rap, you know.
And how did you start writing your own rhymes?
I was a big fan of the music. Would try to find it on every station, you know, and there wasn't a lot of rap around, period. You know, it was kind of like, if you didn't catch it, you missed it, because it was nowhere to be found. And I was about 14, and I was taking a typing class, which I hated. But, you know, it was the best thing for me now that
Yeah, little did you know you'd be writing screenplays. Yeah,
but and I was in the class, and I had finished my work, and a guy named Kiddo turned around and said, have you ever wrote a rap before? And I said, no. And he said, You write one, I'll write one. We'll see which one's the best at the end of the class. And I just never stopped writing from there.
And when did you actually take the mic?
It was a while. You know, I used to go down to a guy named Sir Jinx. He's one of my early first producers. And he's actually Dr. Dre's cousin. That's how I met Dr. Dre, through him. But I went, and he had DJ equipment, you know. And, you know, back then, you know, for Christmas, you'd have your mother buy a turntable, his mother buy a microphone, that guy buy some records, you know, and we kind of piece it together. And we had enough pieces to just start messing around. So, you know, I finally had got a mic in my hand, and, you know, he really actually helped me with my flow and how to really bring it across, you know. And that's where it started. So,
no, did you do parties first?
We did everything. You know, when we met Dre, Dre was well established in Los Angeles hip hop as a party thrower. And he told us, yo, you know, I'm throwing a party here in Compton. If you want to come and get on the mic, you better be good, because if you're not, they're going to boo you out the building. So we geared up and went and did that. And that just kind of turned us on and sparked us. And, you know, I always had to hit the stage after that.
Did you ever get booed out of the building?
Yeah, we've been booed before. I mean, as NWA, we've been booed out the Apollo. When we first came on the scene, we went to the Apollo, and they had like a kind of like a rap convention. So we were one of the guests on there. So we got up there, and you know, they just wasn't ready for these dudes from the West Coast with all this profanity and you know, these Jerry curls and Raider hats and all this. They wasn't ready for it, you know. But the next time we came back, which was actually a few months later, the record was big and they loved us.
So how did you personally deal with being rejected by the audience? Were you angry? Was your ego bruised? Did you feel like, well, now I'm a failure? Or did you feel like, I'll show them, I'll come back and I'll be a star?
Well, you know, we always felt like, well, damn, you know, this is the mecca of hip hop in New York, mm-hmm. but they seem slow because the rest of the country love us. So we always looked at that as strange, because we always thought New York was the forefront. Mm-hmm. And here they were behind on a genre of the music, you know, gangster rap. It was a step behind. And that we recognize that. We recognize that, you know, they'll catch up sooner or later, and they did.
Before you started doing gangster rap, did you ever do just, you know, party rap?
Yeah, we tried that. You know, we tried to sound like all the groups that we love, you know, from Run DMC, the Beastie Boys, you know. Everybody that was out at the time when we started, which was about 84, 85, 86, we were emulating those groups. But it wasn't until we started doing, like, offbeat mixtapes for the neighborhood. Like, we would make a tape for a guy in the neighborhood, and he would want you to rap on it. And then we started making raps about the neighborhood for the guys in the neighborhood. And that got a bigger response than anything, because people seemed to be able to connect. And nobody was talking about the things that we were talking about. And we found our niche and kind of never looked back.
What were some of the early things about the neighborhood that you started talking about?
I mean, 80s, Los Angeles, a lot of crack, a lot of gang banging, a lot of unseen police brutality before the Rodney King stuff. I mean, a lot of stuff we was going through in those neighborhoods, man, that the world had never even talked about or, you know, acknowledged.
My guest is Ice Cube. He stars in the new family comedy, Are We There Yet? We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ice Cube. He stars in the new family comedy, Are We There Yet?, which opens later this month. Although the movie is PG-13, his music, which we'll soon hear, is not, but we did bleep it for broadcast. Now, you grew up in South Central.
Yes.
What was the neighborhood you were from like when you were a kid?
My neighborhood was you know, the thing about Los Angeles is very unpredictable, and it's, you know, the streets are nice, the lines are manicured, and, you know, and it's this big gang culture that always was, you know, like a bad storm that never kind of went away, that was kind of always looming. You know, whether it was raining or not, it was still looming. So you always had a mixture of talented people, sports people, you know, gangsters. You know, it was always that mix. And, you know, 80% of the time it was cool, but 20% of the time, you know, it was hell. So as a kid, you always thought about that 20% of the time, no matter how much fun you was having. So in looking back at it, you know, it's really only added to my life. You know, it's only added to my character and my strength growing up in South Central Los Angeles.
I want to play one of the famous N.W.A. records, mm-hmm. and this is Straight Outta Compton.
Yeah.
You're rapping, you wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to say anything about it before we hear it? This became like a signature rap.
Yeah. I mean, Straight Outta Compton was us trying to scream to the world kind of what we were living, going through, how we felt. You know, for rappers, a lot of rappers will say that doing the music is a great stress reliever. It relieves tension. It's a way to take your anger, frustrations, your ego, and kind of give it a form. And, you know, that's what it was for us. It's kind of us kind of screaming at the top of our lungs, not only what's going on in the neighborhood, but the ego that's a part of rap. You know, a lot of people don't realize ego, bravado,
mm-hmm.
it's a part of the music. You really, you know, it's as essential as rhyming to a certain extent. You know, that's what this is. This is to tell the world where we're coming from and how we're coming, and to be warned, because we were the world's most dangerous group.
And here it is, Straight Outta Compton. This is N.W.A. with my guest, Ice Cube.
Niggas without a chick. Niggas without a chick. Niggas without a chick.
I'm coming straight out of Compton.
When something happens in South Central Los Angeles, nothing happens. It's just another nigga dead.
straight out of Compton. Crazy motherfucker on Ice Cube. From the gang called niggas with attitudes. When I'm called off, I got a sawed off. Squeeze a trigger and bodies are hauled off. You too, boy, if you with me. The police are gonna have to come and get me off your ass. That's how I'm going out. But a punk motherfucker I'm showing out. Niggas start to mumble. They wanna rumble. Mix them and cook them in a pot like gumbo. Going off on the motherfucker like that.
That's Ice Cube in his days with N.W.A. That's from the late 1980s, Straight Outta Compton. And Ice Cube is starring in a movie that he just produced, which is called Are We There Yet? It's a family comedy that's about to open. You sang about the gangster lifestyle. How much did you become an actual part of that?
You know, I don't think you can grow up in the neighborhood without being a part of it to a certain extent, and especially in Los Angeles, because wherever you from, wherever your mother house was the gang you were from, whether you wanted to or not. You know, I'm gonna put it like this. Every day, you never knew what degree you was gonna participate, because every day was different. So some days, you know, I was heavily involved. Some days I just wasn't feeling it. The older I got, the less I would want to deal with that, because it was so many other things that I was into, which was music, sports, mm-hmm. you know, but it was just all around. You know, my neighborhood was kind of saturated with gangster, gangbanging, crack, but it's also saturated with family living, good times, playing ball on the street. It was like both.
So you were in a gang?
I don't like to say that, because, you know, me, I wasn't a active gang member. I didn't go out and kill nobody, mm-hmm. shoot nobody, or rob nobody, because that wasn't what I was about. And if in the neighborhood, you know, I picked up an AK before and was willing to use it. Thank God I didn't have to. So, you know, it was just kind of a situation where you had to be ready to do anything.
When you say you were willing to use it, what was the circumstance?
You know, it was a circumstance where somebody had kind of tricked my mother out of some money, you know, and I knew that, you know, this person was heavily on drugs, and they kind of used her kindness and him knowing me as a way to, you know, to get money. And it was a small amount of money, but it was the principle behind it. And, you know, at that time in my life, you know, I really didn't think about the big picture. And, you know, we was pretty mad, you know, looking for the guy. And, you know, we went to his house. He wasn't there. And, you know, I'm glad he wasn't there, because my whole life would have been different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
What'd your mother think of this? What'd your mother think of knowing that you were willing to take a gun to?
Oh, she didn't know.
Uh-huh.
She didn't know nothing about it.
What'd you think about the kind of rapping that you were doing? Did she feel like this is a bad influence on you? You're singing about things that are dangerous. You're hanging out with the wrong people. Did she worry that this was leading you in the wrong direction?
No, she was happy that I was rapping and not
doing it,
killing, right. Hanging out on the corner, doing what all my mm-hmm. friends was mm-hmm. doing. She was glad that I had something other to do, to go to the studio. And, you know, so the profanity and the lyrics and everything that we were saying, you know, that was a piece of cake, you know, compared to what other mothers was going through in the neighborhood. Funerals, prison visits, school, you know, just bad things happening in school, or just mothers who were going with kids with a big bad drug problem. So, you know, she didn't care what I was rapping about, just as long as I had a mic in my hand and not a gun.
Now, I've read that when you were young, your father was very strict.
Mm-hmm.
Did he not allow you to curse in the house?
Well, you know, you know, he was the only one that can curse in the house. he just demanded a lot of respect. And he demanded for kids to respect adults. And we did. You know, thank God he was still there. You know, I got a story that, you know, a lot of people don't have, which is the story of a mother and father raising them. And, you know, I was just glad he was there. So he's the biggest influence on my life to this day, as far as how to be a man, how to handle your business, how to play with the cards that's dealt. Don't complain about it.
Did your parents work at UCLA?
Yeah, they were custodians at UCLA, both my parents. And my father was a groundskeeper.
Ice Cube stars in the new movie, Are We There Yet? He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ice Cube. In the late 80s, he became famous as a gangster rapper with the group N.W.A. Now he has his own movie production company that's made several films he's starred in, including the comedies Friday and Barbershop, as well as their sequels. His new film is the family comedy Are We There Yet, which opens later this month. Although the movie is PG-13, his records are not. This is one of his best-known songs as a solo performer. It's called It Was a Good Day. We've bleeped it for broadcast.
Just waking up in the morning, gotta thank God. I don't know, but today seems kinda odd. No barking from the dog, no small. And mama cooked the breakfast with no hog. I got my grub on, but didn't dig out. Finally got a call from a girl I wanna dig out. So hooked it up for later as I hit the dough. Thinking, will I live another 24? I gotta go, cause I got me a drop top. And if I hit the switch, I can make the ass drop. Had to stop at a red light. Looking in my mirror, not a jacker in sight. And everything is alright. I got a beat from Kim, and she can f*** all night. Up the homies and I'm asking y'all, which part are y'all playing basketball? Get me on the court and I'm troubled. Last week, around and got a triple-double. Freaking niggas every way like MJ. I can't believe today was a good day.
Now, the NWA music and your own music when you went solo had a lot of profanity
mm-hmm.
in it. So you knew that unless there was like a radio remix, it couldn't get played on the radio. What were some of the ways you got heard when it came to records that couldn't get radio airplay because of the profanity?
You know, that's the phenomenon of it. We, you know, sold double platinum without, you know, any radio support. Our records just couldn't get played, and even if we cleaned them up, the content just wasn't, radio wasn't ready for it. MTV wasn't ready for us. You know, our first video that we ever did, which was Straight Outta Compton, was banned on MTV, and to this day, they still won't play it, you know, and it's kind of tame.
What was on the image? What was the image part?
They just didn't like, you know, young black kids just trying to get away from the police and, you know, and just the images. And, you know, they just didn't want to see that. And so it kind of, you know, struck people and kind of took them back. And, you know, we got a lot of resistance going on tour. You know, we went on tour in the summer. Well, not in the summer, but the spring, summer 89. We went on tour and we would have the chief of police show up with an ordinance. You know, if you say this, if you do this, when you're going to jail, if you, you know, we couldn't perform our most famous song, which was F the Police. We couldn't perform that because they just said if you perform that, the tour is over. So, you know, it was just all kind of things we were going through. But
did Did you always comply? Did you always comply with the police orders you were given?
No, no, nah. We, you know, we did it how we felt it. You know, we would tell the kids out in the audience what just happened to us backstage, you know, and all kind of stuff. Because we loved it, because we had got a letter even from the FBI. You know,
what did it say?
It just said that we were the cause of, you know, cop killings all over the country, and, you know, our music was, you know, the worst thing that could ever be produced, and we should stop, basically. But, you know, growing up where we was from, with the LAPD and how, and the sheriffs, and how they really put their hands on you, a letter, chief of police reading an ordinance, none of that, all that was a walk in the park compared to how we grew up every day. So this was like, you know, we didn't take any of it serious.
Were you ever arrested after a concert?
Yeah, we never went downtown, but we were detained and cited in Cincinnati. And in Detroit, the police jumped on stage to get us off. They actually, during the performance, like, jumped on the stage and
did that all ultimately, like, add to the legend and lore surrounding NWA?
You know, you would have to ask a fan. I think so. Because just like the music, it was things that we didn't plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we never planned for the music to take us to these heights. We always thought that we would be superstars in the neighborhood. You know, we always thought that as long as they loved us around our neighborhood, where else would you rather be, you know?
Do you feel the same way about the police that you did when you recorded F the Police?
Some of them, yeah.
But not all of them?
You can't say all about anything and be right, you know.
So no regrets about the record?
None. I don't regret any record that I've done, because a record is kind of like a time capsule, you know. It's a it's how you feeling at that point and at that time, you know. So you regretting it is kind of regretting living, you know.
Things, among the things that made NWA controversial was F the Police, comments about women,
mm-hmm.
Koreans,
mm-hmm.
One line in particular about somebody who was Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, now that you're older,
mm-hmm.
if you have any second thoughts about any of the things that you said that struck people at the time as either being misogynist or anti-Korean or anti-Semitic.
Well, you know, nobody wants to be misunderstood. You know, the only thing I regret in any of those cases is if I ever had my facts mixed up, because when you're young, you have a picture of the world, and when you get older, you realize, okay, it's a different picture than what I thought. So, but, you know, everybody got attacked on NWA records, you know, black people the most. You know, everybody gets it. Nobody's exempt from the truth, or nobody's exempt from reality. Just because it's not done in a so-called, I guess, diplomatic way, it's kind of done.
Well, I'll give an example. Like, pay respect to the Black Fist. This is an anti-Korean thing. Pay respect to the Black Fist, or we'll burn your store right down to a crisp, and then we'll see you, because you can't turn the ghetto into Black Korea.
Yeah, that's a song called Black Korea that I did. And it was a song which really talked about the relationship between black people in their own communities and Koreans who come in and set up shop, which is not a problem. But when you set up shop and then disrespect your patrons and disrespect the people who are coming in to shop at your store, then that's a problem. Nobody would address that. So I addressed it the best way I can see fit, which was to make a record about it. And if you go back and look at the whole record, not just those few lyrics, then the record is kind of self-explanatory on what the black community was feeling, including myself. You know, that record was done in 1991. And just a year later, the riots showed the people that this is how the community was really feeling. People didn't attack Korean stores during the riots of 92 because of my record. They did it because there was a sentiment feeling. There was a hurt going through our community. We used to talk about going to the stores and how everybody from your mama to your grandmama to your daughter to your son is getting disrespected.
My guest is Ice Cube. He stars in the new family comedy, Are We There Yet? We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ice Cube. He stars in the new family comedy, Are We There Yet? He made his movie debut in Boys in the Hood, playing a young man in South Central L.A. whose brother was killed by a gang. Here's a scene in which he's talking to a friend shortly after the murder.
I've been up this early in a long time. Turned on the TV this morning. Had this on about living in a violent world. Showed all these foreign places. Foreigners living on. Started thinking, man. Either they don't know, don't show, or don't care about what's going on in the hood. They had all this foreign shit. They ain't have shit on my brother, man. I ain't got no brother.
You have a performing career as well as a music career.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of rappers, kind of like a lot of people in every genre of music, are kind of one-hit wonders, or they have their moment of fame, and then it's kind of over.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to get a day job or you know, you just lose track of what's happened to them. But you, mm-hmm. you've been one of the really successful people. You have your own production company. You've mm-hmm. starred in a lot of movies. I mean, you're doing terrifically, and it sounds like you have a lot of creative control too, mm-hmm. which I'm sure is very gratifying. How did you start making movies? I mean, how did you first make that transition from rap to film?
It's about 1989. NWA, we had just released our records. They were big. I was on tour and just kind of engulfed in the moment. And a youngster, a couple of years younger than me, kind of walked up and said, "Hey, yo, you know, I think we might be the same age." But he said, "Yo, man, I got this movie. You'll be perfect for it." And I'm a junior at USC, and I'm gonna try to get it made, man. And I want you to star in it.
This would be John Singleton.
This is John Singleton. You know, I'm looking at him. I'm like, yeah, right. Whatever, man. So he sees me a year later. This is after I broke out with NWA, broke off the group, and was kind of going solo. And he said, "Yo, I'm a senior at USC, man, and still got that movie." And I'm like, "Yeah, I remember you." Blew him off again. And then, later on that year, I got a script. And my manager said, "A script came in for you. They want you to read for it." And I said, "What is it?" "Some script called Boys in the Hood." I said, "All right, whatever." She gave it to me. I just put it up. And I said, "When do you want me to read?" And, you know, I'm trying to make a long story short. She said, "Going on Wednesday." So I went in, and I saw the guy. I'm like, "Oh, this is your movie." He said, "Yeah, did you read it?" I said, "No." He said, "Man, go read my movie and come back, and, you know, and I'm going to give you a shot. If you want to do it, tell me you don't want to do it." So I went and read it, got it. You know, this is my neighborhood. This is history of my life in Los Angeles. I have to do this. So, you know, from then on, it's kind of kicked it off. And Boys in the Hood was the first movie I ever did. And, you know, got nominated for an Oscar, and, you know, it was just a hell of a ride. We went to Cannes Film Festival, and I just got bit by the bug from there and kind of wanted to be a part of good movies.
Now, you've done every kind of movie. You did, you know, Boys in the Hood, which is a drama about growing up in South Central L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Three Kings, which is a war movie set in Iraq.
Yes.
Trespass, which mm-hmm. is a kind of crime movie.
Yeah.
You've produced and starred in a bunch of comedies, the Barbershop films, the Friday films. Now you're producing and starring in a family comedy, Are We There Yet? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, you know, a bunch of different genres, but you seem to be heading more and more toward comedy.
You know, it's just in Hollywood, it seems like the path of least resistance.
Why is that?
You know, people rather laugh than cry. And that's the philosophy of Hollywood, especially when it comes to black films. They just seem to support the comedies more than the dramas about our experiences. So starting my company and trying to gain respect, we kind of went the path of least resistance, which was to make the comedies, get them made, you know, show that they can generate money, you know, to hopefully later on in my career to bring some dramas to the front of our experiences.
To talk about the Friday films, there's been three of them.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe a little bit about how the idea got started and how you decided to do it?
A few movies that came out, like The Boys in the Hoods, The Menace to Societies, a movie called South Central. These were movies that showed our neighborhood as just kind of a hellhole, you know. And in growing up in South Central, you know, you realize that it's bad, but you're feeling, I mean, it's home. You know, home is never all bad. So I just said, you know, growing up, man, you know, the neighborhood felt a little funner than what's being depicted. You know, so with the Friday movies, if you really look at them, it's a lighthearted look at kind of all the bad things that happen in the neighborhood, but a lighthearted look, like a look at, of it through youngsters' eyes or teenagers' eyes or even a kid's eyes, how they would see these same situations, which is how we saw them growing up, you know. You know, it was easier, and we laughed at the neighborhood crackhead. And he wasn't like this tragic figure that, you know, they'll show on 2020. You know, he was like, you know, funny dude, a tragic figure, but a funny dude in the neighborhood. So I just kind of, I thought that that kind of take had never been shown in America, really, about South Central and that kind of spin off of it. And, you know, people love it. It's like a cult classic now.
My guest is Ice Cube. He stars in the new family comedy, Are We There Yet? We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is rap star, actor, and producer Ice Cube. Let's hear a scene from the film Three Kings, which he starred in with Mark Wahlberg, Spike Jonze, and George Clooney. They play American soldiers in Iraq shortly after the first Gulf War. One of them finds a map hidden on a captured Iraqi soldier. Cube is looking at the map, which they believe will lead to a bunker where Saddam Hussein has hidden expensive goods stolen from Kuwait.
Get the story. Okay.
Now, these have got to be Saddam's bunkers right here between Kabbalah and Nasiriyah.
What's inside?
According to intel, Picasso, Sony, Armani, Rolex, Kuwait was like the heir of Beverly Hills, and Saddam jacked them for it.
It'd be nice to bring something home besides sand, please.
One gold Rolex gave me a very nice split-level house outside of Garland.
Five Rolexes to get my family. That Lexus convertible.
I told you Lexus doesn't make a convertible.
Yes, they do. It has room in the back for a kid's seat.
Infinity has a convertible, but not Lexus.
Wrong.
Either way, the good Lord has put this map in our path, and I believe we're going to find something.
Yeah, we could also put a landmine in our path if we go out there.
I don't think so. I've been fire baptized, and this one feels safe.
What the hell are you talking about?
I have a ring of Jesus fire to guide my decisions.
You're putting me on, right?
Do it look like I'm putting you on?
Okay, ring of Jesus fire.
Oh!
That's Ice Cube in a scene from Three Kings. We're talking about his film career and his career as a rapper. What was it like for you to watch suburban kids who were middle class and often white copying the kind of gangster image of the gangster rappers?
You know, people gonna copy what they feel's cool. You know, whatever, you know, somebody feels cool, they're gonna copy. It doesn't bother me. I didn't mind it at all. And I definitely understand where they're coming from.
Which is where?
Which is a lot of kids are unhappy with the way the world is being ran. You know, and when you talk about white kids, it seems like they're directly in conflict with how their parents, their grandparents, or their generations have run things, not only in the world, but in their lives. And our music is what all kids kind of, you know, gravitate to, which is being kind of anti-authority and, you know, being a rebel and saying what's on your mind, saying it how you feel, expressing yourself. And, you know, a lot of kids, you know, do it as trying to find an identity, trying to rebel against what their parents is kind of leading them to. And, you know, just in that, they're at that age where they want to rebel. And our music is that kind of music. And it's, to me, it's just the perfect match, so to speak.
Now, obviously, you've become something of a businessman, too, because if you have your own production company, mm-hmm. that's having to deal with the business end. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who become suddenly famous and wealthy when they're young can't deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
They spend their money foolishly, mm-hmm. lose a lot of it or all of it, don't know how to handle the money or themselves with their newfound fame. You managed to get through that pretty well, and as I say, you've got your own production company. It's doing really well. What was that early period like for you when you were hit with fame and money and you had to figure out how to handle it?
You know, you go through the point where you're happy that you can do some of the things that you always wanted to do, buy some of the things you always wanted to buy. And then I think you hit a point where you feel that people are using you, you
mm-hmm,
know,
mm-hmm.
even close to you, you know, family members, friends, you know, everybody wants to borrow, everybody wants to use. And you get to a point where you feel like I'm helping everybody. Nobody's helping me. And if I sink, then I'm going to be the one that everybody talk about. He had money and he lost all his money. But never talk about how they contribute to you losing your money. So I just started, you know, making people come correct and be genuine. And if they wasn't, they wouldn't get nothing from me. And, you know, you just have to kind of, you know, back people off, you know, to be able to breathe and to be able to kind of see clear and figure out who's really in your corner.
Did you go through a period of being, like, really ostentatious with the money? Just, like, buying things to show, that would show your success?
Nah, I was never like that. You know, my father instilled in me that, you know, the car don't make the man, the clothes don't make the man, the jewelry don't make the man make the man, you know? Why would you have somebody looking at your car more than they looking at you? You know, so those kind of things always stuck with me. Don't, you know, you are the shining light, you know, not what trinket you can buy.
Is your father still alive?
Yeah.
He must be pretty proud of you.
He say, I'm living the life of Riley. That's what he say about himself. So he pretty cool, you know. He's been working all his life, you know, hardworking man, just retired, you know, and, you know, I've been spoiling him rotten, you know, because, hey, why not? You know, I got it. He shouldn't have to worry about it. So, yeah, I've been trying to spoil my father rotten.
And one of the many controversies surrounding gangster rap has been, is it bad for young people to be exposed to this? Are gangster rappers bad role models and so on? As a father, and you have children ranging from 4 to 17 now, do I have the ages right?
Yes. Quarter 18.
For 18. Mm-hmm. What was your approach to how much you should expose them to gangster rap and to your own records?
Well, you know, I believe you're not going to be there with your kids through everything they hear and everything they listen to. You know, what's worked for me is instilling in my kids a level of self-respect. And in doing that, it's kind of helped them through all these situations, through all this, you know, to weed through the music, the movies, the magazines, the news, you know, because it's some horrific stuff that's even shown on the news. So I've just kind of given them a balance of not hiding anything from them, but trying to explain everything to them. Explain to them show business, writing songs, producing songs, what it's really all about.
How did you explain profanity to them?
I explain profanity as language. There's language. There's good language, so-called, and there's so-called bad language. But it's all an expression of people. And there's appropriate times to use any kind of language. You know, kids, if you tell them don't use profanity, they'll say, okay. But when they get on the playground with their kids, you know, cuss like sailors. Just like I did when I was a kid, and you probably did when you were. So that's unrealistic. What's realistic is have respect. You know, an adult should never hear you say these words. You know, if you want to use these words around your friends, you know, that's really on you.
Can I ask you one dumb question?
Please.
This is very dumb.
Okay.
Do you think of yourself as being Ice Cube or Ice Cube? Or does it... Does it matter?
I don't know. What was the difference between Ice Cube and Ice Cube?
Where the emphasis is on the first or the last word. And if it's Ice Cube, it really sounds like the Ice Cube. And if it's Ice Cube, I don't know. I've never...
All my friends call me Cube.
Okay.
You know, if you know me real good, call me Cube. I'll respond to that. But I don't know. I think I'll debate that.
I'm overthinking
Ice Cube
this.
Or I'm Ice Cube.
I've obviously overthought this. Thank you so much.
All right.
Ice Cube stars in the new movie, Are We There Yet? It opens later this month.